and welcome back to another riveting episode of Robbinsdale Revisited, where we dust off the old archives and look at the wild, rowdy, and sometimes explosive history of our favorite town. I'm Crystal Boyd, a member of the Robbinsdale Historical Society.
And I'm Pete Ritchie, president of the Robbinsdale Historical Society. Today, listeners, we're expanding our look into the early and later 1900s liquor wars of Robbinsdale. If you think small town politics are dramatic now, wait until you hear about the time our village was labeled as a wet sinkhole and a disgrace by our neighbors.
Oh, and it was an absolute mess. To understand why Robbinsdale became the center of the universe for thirsty Minnesotans, you have to look at what was happening right across the border in Minneapolis. Back in 1905, Minneapolis had a strict Sunday closing rule for its saloons. It was called the Lynn Ordinance, and it basically meant that if you wanted a drink on Sunday, Minneapolis was a ghost town.
And naturally, human nature being what it is, people didn't just stop drinking because it was Sunday. Instead, all the thirsty folks from the city hopped on streetcars and headed straight for the village limits of Robbinsdale to hit what the papers called the rural jag shops. The Minneapolis Tribune reported that streetcars were packed on Sunday mornings, loaded to the guards with folks that were just looking to tie one on.
That means Robbinsdale basically became the busiest place in Hennepin County on Sundays. But this massive influx caused a total culture war right here in town. There were two sides. One side insisted Robbinsdale was a quiet, law-abiding hamlet that shouldn't be corrupted by city slickers. And the other side was convinced the town was on a one-way road to perdition and that the local authorities were actively in league with evil.
And the pressure on local leaders was immense. Back in November 1905, Village President Gus Urban and Councilman Johnson actually took a trip to Minneapolis to meet with the mayor and try to figure out how to stop the madness. Urban publicly declared Sunday behavior was a disgrace, noting that local saloon keepers were placarding the town, advertising turkey raffles and shooting matches just to lure crowds. Imagine walking out of church and seeing a sign for a booze-fueled shotgun contest next door.
And things got incredibly tense for the next mayor, Charles Schuler, by 1909. We actually found the exact letter that was sent to him by Minnesota Attorney General George T. Simpson. He sent it in July of 1909, and Simpson did not mince words. He told Schuler directly that if he willfully failed to shut down the Sunday drinking, the state would move in and remove him from office for malfeasance.
Talk about a high-stakes job. So Mayor Schuler actually took a trip to St. Paul for what the papers called a heart-to-heart at the Attorney General's office. He categorically denied everything and tried to explain that the town was just too spread out for him to police it all. Tensions got so high locally that Village Councilman T.A. Tyler literally fainted on a street corner while arguing about it with a passionate resident.
And it all led to a massive public demonstration at the town hall on August 25th, 1909. Jack Thielen, he was the proprietor of the Point Saloon, started shouting from the back of the room, demanding to know why he was being singled out when everyone was making money. He even got into a screaming match with the town marshal, who was a guy named Rice.
The crowd was losing its mind until Andrew B. Robbins himself, the literal father and founder of the village, stood up and beseeched them, "Gentlemen, let us act in a businesslike way. Let us not besmirch our town any further." The council finally agreed to hire a special policeman to enforce the liquor laws.
But enforcing the law back then was like playing whack-a-mole, because it wasn't just late hours, it was illegal gambling, too. We found an article from 1899 about a Robbinsdale saloon man named Louis Metzler. He got hauled into court for running a nickel in the slot machine. That's what we would call an early slot machine. He pleaded guilty, thinking he'd get off easy with a slap on the wrist, and instead, the judge hit him with a massive $100 fine.
In 1899 money? That's a fortune. That's easily over $3,000 today. He allegedly shouted in open court, "Do you think I'm a robber or a murderer? It was only a little funny machine for amusement."
But to be fair, the liquor trade here had a genuinely dark, tragic side, too. It all centered around the most controversial spot in town, the Crystal Lake Point Saloon, which the locals simply called The Point. It was a two-story frame building built right on West Broadway, which was known as Crystal Lake Road back then, and it was built by the Minneapolis Brewing Company in 1903.
Yeah, it was a classic setup. The first floor had a main bar room and a back drinking room. If you had a few too many, you could actually rent a sleeping compartment on the second floor. For years, the proprietor, a guy named Jack C. Thielen, he was constantly in the crosshairs of the local temperance movement.
Yeah, he really was. And at that rowdy town hall meeting, things got incredibly personal. The leader of the anti-saloon faction was a man named J.H. Morse. He stood up and accused the town marshal Rice of being in cahoots with the saloons.
And this is where Jack Thielen started shouting from the back of the room. He cut off the meeting to defend his honor, claiming that he only sold low-alcohol malt liquor on Sundays. He publicly called out Morris, saying, "Hey, remember that Sunday you called the marshal down to my place, claiming 200 men were inside drinking hard liquor?"
And then Morse fired right back. He told the crowd, "Yeah, because it took the marshal 15 minutes to go actually inside, which gave you plenty of time to sound the alarm and hide the booze." Well, Marshal Rice completely blew his stack at that. He threatened Morse right there in front of the mayor, basically saying, like, if there weren't witnesses around, he would take Morse out back and teach him a lesson for attacking his good name.
Yep. Mayor Schuler had to step in as a referee to stop a literal fistfight between the town's anti-saloon leader and the police chief. Right after the smoke cleared, Thielen actually decided he'd had enough of the drama and sold the saloon to a guy named Edward Bocher in May of 1910.
Bocher didn't know it, but he bought into a ticking time bomb. Just 1 month later, on June 28, 1910, tragedy struck. At exactly 4:22 p.m., a time verified on a gold watch found on the body of the bartender, Charles Giebenhain, a massive acetylene gas tank in the basement exploded.
And the blast was horrific. The Pure Weekly newspaper all the way out in South Dakota even picked up the story, reporting that the explosion literally shot the first and second floors skyward, carrying the bar fixtures and the contents of the cellar and the patrons up into the air before the roof caved in and the splintered wreckage caved back down into the pit of the basement.
The detonation could be heard for miles. A fierce fire immediately broke out, but amid the chaos, there were some miraculous escapes. There were four women who had been sitting out back, just chatting over steins of beer when the bomb went off. Neighbors found them staggering through the smoke, their faces blackened and scorched by the blast.
And a kind neighbor named William Koenig rushed them to his home to give them first aid. His wife, Mrs. Koenig, actually had to give two of the women her own clothes because theirs had been completely blown to ribbons. In total, five men were killed instantly. Investigators found the gas pipes had clogged and created a massive buildup of pressure.
It was such a disaster that a few weeks later, when word got out that the Minneapolis Brewing Company was brazenly planning to rebuild another saloon right on top of those ashes, the residents of North Minneapolis started aggressively circulating a petition. They begged the Robbinsdale Council, please refuse any further liquor licenses for this property. So the tragedy at the Point was the beginning of the end for the local liquor trade.
Yeah, and the tragedy surrounding the saloon didn't stop with the explosion. Just a few months later, in October 1910, a bizarre, mysterious death took place in the area. A 26-year-old man named James Miller was found dead in a barn behind Owen Finnerty's saloon on Crystal Lake Road.
Yeah, and this is a wild story. James and his brother, George Miller, had gone to the saloon that morning. Later that day, James was found dead in a buggy inside the barn. He had severe, unexplained bruises to his head and chest. The bartender claimed James must have gotten dizzy and fallen out of the buggy and died accidentally.
Yeah, the family didn't buy it for a second. To make things weirder, George Miller, the brother, completely vanished for a couple days before popping back up to reveal there had been a massive drunken brawl in the tavern. And get this, it turns out George was actually one of the lucky survivors who had been badly injured in the Point explosion just months earlier. Talk about bad luck. The sheriff ended up arresting a man named Elmer Hamblin for the fight and jailed the saloon owner for illegal Sunday sales.
With all the chaos, local citizens and the Hennepin County grand jury finally cracked down. By 1916, Robbinsdale had completely voted to go dry under a local option law. And the craziest part of the story is that the economic turnaround was immediate.
Yeah, a local pastor, Reverend W.J. Warner, actually used Robbinsdale as a shining example to convince the neighboring St. Louis Park to dump their saloons. He interviewed Robbinsdale business owners who confessed they used to be staunch wets, but completely changed their minds once alcohol left.
A local meat market owner told him, My business is decidedly better, and my collections are a great deal easier. Bankers and hardware merchants like George Nash and W.W. Farr noted that as soon as the saloons left, real estate boomed. Home builders, who used to refuse to bring their families to Robbinsdale because of its reputation, were suddenly buying up lots.
And Village Council President William H. Johnson summed it up perfectly in 1916. He said that when Robbinsdale was wet, is one of the worst, most disgraceful places in Minnesota night after night. But after going dry, they went an entire year with only one single arrest for drunkenness.
But if you thought national prohibition in the 1920s finally brought peace and quiet to Robbinsdale, think again, because in 1920, the entire country went dry under the 18th Amendment. And that brings us to a part of history that's uniquely Minnesotan. Pete, could you tell us a little bit about the guy who wrote the enforcement law for prohibition?
Oh, that would be Congressman Andrew Volstead, who hailed from right here in Minnesota. The Volstead Act defined intoxicating liquor as anything containing more than 0.5% alcohol. But right before prohibition was completely repealed in 1933, Congress passed something called the Cullen-Harrison Act. President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed it, famously saying, "I think this would be a good time for a beer."
This law made a new legal distinction. It declared that beer with an alcohol content of 3.2% by weight was officially non-intoxicating. So just let that sink in. The government legally decreed that 3.2% beer could not get you drunk.
This created a bizarre hybrid world where the national prohibition officially ended on December of 1933. States were allowed to regulate alcohol however they wanted. And Minnesota, with its deep-seated temperance roots, thanks to our teetotaling Scandinavian settlers, they constantly locked horns with glass-raising German-Polish immigrants and decided to keep 3.2 beer as a separate legal category. So alcohol, weight versus volume. 3.2% alcohol by weight is actually equal to 4% alcohol by volume. For comparison, a standard light beer today sits around 4.2 ABV. So near beer wasn't quite water, but it was treated just like juice.
And that distinction meant that while you had to go to a strict state-sanctioned exclusive liquor store if you wanted whiskey or heavy wine, that 3.2 beer could be sold liberally in grocery stores, gas stations, and special 3.2 taverns. So as we're going to see, the single legal quirk shaped the entire social fabric of Robbinsdale for the next 40 years.
Yeah, but before legal 3.2 beer started flowing in Robbinsdale, we had to get through the actual bootlegging era of the 1920s. Our neck of the woods, with its rolling hills, quiet farms, became prime landscape for hidden stills and gangland shootouts.
Ooh, let's start in November of 1926. Federal prohibition agents raided a farm just west of Robbinsdale, and they didn't find just a few bottles of moonshine, like, hidden up in a hayloft. They uncovered a massive 250-gallon industrial still, plus 25 gallons of ready-to-go moonshine, and a staggering 3,000 gallons of fermenting mash. A guy named Maurice Thompson was hauled off to the city jail.
And that was just a warm-up for what went down in August of 1930. Federal agents raided the south end of the Ed Corbett farm about 6 miles northwest of town. This wasn't a small-time operation. It was a major manufacturing plant run by a notorious North Minneapolis liquor ring. Agents seized 350-gallon stills, and thousands of gallons worth of mash.
The farmer, Ed Corbett, claimed he was totally duped. He told the newspapers that these guys had approached him a few weeks prior, renting the land under the guise of fattening up cattle from Montana. Corbett claimed that the moment he realized they were cooking moonshine instead of feeding steers, he ordered them off the property. But by then, the feds were already watching.
So this is where the story turns into a literal Hollywood gangster movie. As the deputy prohibition administrator, Morris Silverman, was inspecting the seized farm equipment, Corbett's mother spotted a car driving suspiciously back and forth on the highway outside. She pointed her finger and said, "That looks like the men who rented the farm."
Agent Silverman didn't hesitate. He hopped in his car, drove out to the highway, and flagged them down. but as he started questioning the men, the driver slammed the car into gear to escape. Silverman, total action hero mode, leaped onto the vehicle's external running board and grabbed the steering wheel through the window to force them into a ditch.
But these weren't ordinary backwoods bootleggers. The passengers in the car were Harry Hoppe and Vernon Miller, notorious hardcore North Minneapolis gangland figures who already had a long rap sheet for assaulting law enforcement. One of them pulled a pistol and fired two shots point blank at Silverman, throwing him violently off the running board as the car sped away.
Unbelievably, the shots missed and Silverman escaped with just minor bruises from hitting the dirt. But it goes to show that the rural roads around Robbinsdale were prime territory for real-deal dangerous gangsters.
Yep, and that was easy money back then. But now, while some people were dodging bullets, one Robbinsdale resident decided the best way to handle prohibition was to laugh at it. In 1919, a local veteran named Wilford Fawcett launched a joke magazine right out of a small office in Robbinsdale called Captain Billy's Whizbang.
Ah, Whizbang! It became a national phenomenon. It fed into the exact counterculture that prohibition created, mocking flappers, speakeasies, corrupt politicians, and general small-town hypocrisy. It turned the whole dry experiment into one giant punchline. Fawcett eventually became a multimillionaire off his publishing empire, proving that while running liquor was dangerous, writing jokes about it was incredibly lucrative.
And by the time the national noble experiment ended in December of 1933, Robbinsdale residents were ready to celebrate. In January of 1934, the village council happily sat down and drew up a brand new liquor control ordinance, officially publishing it, and then they prepared to hand out lucrative liquor licenses. Thirsty residents had their mouths puckered up for martinis and silver fizzies.
And then the Minneapolis Attorney General snatched the glass right out from under Robbinsdale's nose.
Talk about a buzzkill.
Total buzzkill. It turns out there was a legal joker hidden deep in the state's post-prohibition law. Because remember back in 1916, Robbinsdale had voted themselves dry under that local option rule. The city council didn't actually have the power to just pass a new ordinance and legalize alcohol. Instead, the town had to stay completely dry until they could hold a formal, special, local option election. And due to state scheduling laws, that couldn't happen until December of 1934. So Robbinsdale was forced into an extra year of mandatory drought while the rest of the country celebrated.
So eventually the vote passed and legal booze did return. By 1937, classic spots like Adolph's, Jim's Place, and Boffertings Point were up and running on West Broadway. But with the return of taverns came modern corporate problems. In 1936, the proprietor of the Green Mill Tavern, P.L. Munker, was slapped with a federal lawsuit by the president of the ASCAP for copyright infringement. His crime? Playing the national hit song Goody Goody on a phonograph without paying the commercial license fee. They hit this small-town tavern owner for $250 in damages.
Oh, what a pain. They just wanted to dance to Goody Goody. But let's fast forward to the 1940s and World War II. Taverns weren't just places to drink. They became the actual social fabric of the community. And at the Circle Tavern at 2921 West Broadway, that was operated by a wonderful woman named Mrs. Agnes Johnson, where a beautiful tradition was born.
In March of 1943, five young local guys were inducted into the Army. Before they shipped out to the front lines, they brought their civilian neckties to Mrs. Johnson and asked her to keep them safe until they came home. She pinned them to a big mirror behind the tavern bar with a little card showing each soldier's name and induction date.
The necktie rendezvous grew rapidly by word of mouth. Dozens of local boys leaving for the service brought in their neckties, ranging from sober, solid colors to wild, vivid polka dot patterns. Soldiers coming home on brief furloughs even brought back battlefield souvenirs to display on the wall, like a pair of aviator goggles taken from a captured German flyer in Salerno. Mrs. Johnson vowed to keep them safely waiting for that ultimate post-war reunion.
When the war ended, those brave GIs came home, and they brought a fierce fight with them straight to the city council chambers. Two young veteran brothers, James and Thomas Chase, wanted to expand their small hamburger shop into a proper liquor tavern. Another returning veteran, Adolph Julie, wanted to upgrade his 3-2 joint into a full liquor establishment.
The problem was that since 1935, Robbinsdale had a strict ordinance. It capped the number of on-sale hard liquor licenses to just 2. So just 2 licenses in the whole city. And those 2 slots had been locked down for years by a tight, incredibly lucrative monopoly held by the Canteen and the Alcan Club.
Yeah, the Canteen, also known as Menth's Canteen. I think that family is still around here somewhere. The council was split 4-1 against the veterans, but they found a roaring, passionate champion in Mayor Henry Uglum. When the councilman argued they needed a special election to change the rules, Mayor Uglum literally stood up, slammed his fist on the table, and shouted them down, bellowing. Mayor Uglum literally stood up, slammed his fist on the table, and shouted them down, bellowing, "We are the law in this town. To hell with an election. Those boys fought for us. What do we care? Let's change the law right now."
But the other aldermen fired right back, furiously accusing the mayor of trying to look like an angel while making the rest of them look like heartless dummies. They warned him that the local churches were going to fiercely fight any expansion of vice, but Uglum didn't care. He pushed it through, and the council eventually voted to double the licenses from 2 to 4 to accommodate the vets.
And the churches absolutely did fight it. Robbinsdale Ministerial Alliance, led by Congregational Pastor Reverend W.W. Dale, teamed up with the local chapter of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, and they utilized a provision in the new 1940 city charter to launch a massive referendum to petition to block the ordinance.
It went to a bitter, divisive public vote in July of 1946. Neighbors were pitted against neighbors, and by a vote of 979 to 782, the conservative citizens actually defeated the proposal. The expansion was crushed, the veterans lost their newly minted licenses, and the religious groups claimed total victory.
But the committee was still furious about the existing 2-saloon monopoly. People felt that if the vets couldn't get a piece of the pie, nobody should have a private monopoly. By 1947, civic clubs were circulating new petitions. They said, look, if we can't add more private taverns, let's eliminate the private monopoly entirely and build a single municipal liquor store run by the city itself.
And that's exactly what they did. On March 1st, 1948, the official Robbinsdale Municipal On and Off Sale Liquor Store opened its doors on France Avenue. It was an instant, unbelievable gold mine. By August, the city clerk released a report showing that in just its first 5 months, the city-run store brought in over $94,000 in sales, netting more than a clean $13,700 profit directly for the city's taxpayers. And that included a tidy profit of $275 collected just from its public pinball machines.
From moonshine shootouts on area farms to highly profitable city-owned liquor store, Robbinsdale's relationship with alcohol sure came a long way in 50 years. But if you thought the city running the show meant the booze battles were over, hold on to your hats. The 1950s and 60s brought a whole new wave of drama featuring a legendary nightclub, a teenage takeover, and a war over what went into a 3-2 glass of beer.
Let's start with a little detour up north. Back in 1942, a small group of rugged Robbinsdale men headed up to the freezing wilderness to help build the Alaska-Canada Highway for the U.S. Army. And this vital supply route earned the nickname the Oil Can Highway because of the thousands of discarded fuel drums that marked its progress through the mud.
And when the war ended, two of those local builders, Jim Dupuy and Art Beaulieu, came back home to Robbinsdale and bought out the old Truffy DeMar's grocery store near 36th and West Broadway. In honor of their wild wartime deployment, they opened a tavern and named it the Alcan Club.
The original Alcan building was torn down in the late 1950s. It was replaced briefly by a mini golf course before a modern bank went up in 1964. But the Alcan name lived on when it moved down the road to 3700 West Broadway. And by 1954, the Alcan's new proprietor, Tom Stansfield, found himself leading a full-blown rebellion against the city council over a concept that some of our listeners might find completely bizarre, the culture of the setup and spiking.
Now, because Minnesota laws restricted private taverns to selling only 3-2 beer, owners had to find a loophole to appease customers who wanted the hard stuff. Enter the setup. A tavern would provide a glass of ice with carbonated mixer like 7-Up or Coca-Cola. The customer would pull out a flask of whiskey from their coat pocket, which they had bought legally at a liquor store, and then spiked their own drink at the table. So the setup economy kind of worked like this. You had private taverns that were 3-2 beer only, but they could sell setups, ice, and a mixer to customers who brought in their own hidden drinks in their pockets. Municipal liquor stores held an absolute monopoly on legal bottle sales.
Right, but Robbinsdale had an old ordinance sitting idly on the books that strictly prohibited 3-2 beer taverns from selling carbonated beverages or mixers if they had any suspicion that customers were going to pour hard liquor into them. Because the city held a strict monopoly on hard liquor at its own municipal lounge, they didn't want private bars cutting into their profits or creating rowdy environments that they couldn't control.
In 1948, police started a rigid, aggressive, no-spiking crackdown. Officers would literally walk into the private taverns, look at people's tables, and sniff their glasses. Proprietors like Tom Stansfield were losing their shirts because customers were fleeing in droves to neighboring suburbs like Golden Valley and Crystal just to get a proper setup.
Stanfield stood up at a heated city council meeting and demanded that the city prove where spiking was doing any actual harm. He argued it was a victimless crime. But Alderman Don Rose coldly shut him down, asking the room, "If we allow it in a 3-2 place, how can we refuse to allow it in a common grocery store?" The anti-spiking crowd won, the ordinance was upheld, and the crackdown stayed.
Now, the hilarious irony of the city protecting its municipal liquor store monopoly was that the Muni itself was universally considered an absolute unmitigated dump.
Oh, it was pretty awful. So by the 1960s, even Robbinsdale's own mayor, C.O. Wallace, openly trashed the city-owned establishment to the newspapers, famously saying, "It's deplorable. You not only would not want to take your wife in there, you would not want to take your girlfriend in there. You wonder why you took yourself in there. And then you wonder why you have a wife and a girlfriend to take anywhere."
When the mayor was telling people not to go to the city-owned bar, you know it's bad. The legendary Minneapolis Star columnist Jim Klobuchar visited the Muni and wrote a scathing, hilarious review. He stated the lounge achieved a rare architectural distinction of being loud and gloomy at the same time, joking that when patron asked the bartenders for a shot, the bartender genuinely wondered if they wanted Old Taylor whiskey or a tetanus shot.
Naturally, the proud town patrons didn't take too kindly to that. They actually hung Jim Klobuchar in effigy from a lamppost on West Broadway for that column. But the public shaming did work. It forced the city to finally spend the money to remodel the place with fancy stonework and trendy psychedelic lamps, turning it into what Klobuchar later mocked as the Little Paris of West Broadway.
But the real scandal at the Muni came in 1963 when city investigators discovered a major $1,500 shortage in the books. It turned out a bartender named Harold Janish, along with his colleagues, had been actively engaged in free tippling, which is just a fancy way of saying they were heavily drinking expensive liquor on the job without paying for it.
In a recorded interrogation that we uncovered, Janish gave the most hilarious defense. He claimed he tried to pay for his drinks, but the other bartenders on duty stubbornly refused to take his money. He ended up paying back exactly $36.40 for his personal drinks before the city council promptly fired him and his buddies.
While the city was busy bickering over free drinks and bad lighting, a visionary local contractor named John Flaherty looked at West Broadway and saw a massive business opportunity. He looked at an old, grease-coated, abandoned Chinese restaurant called the House of Wu and a defunct six-lane bowling alley right next door at 4123 West Broadway, and he had a wild idea.
And he might not have kept track of all this history of liquor in Robbinsdale, because it turns out to be a bit of a challenge. But in 1966, Flaherty and his business partner spent a massive $60,000, which was an absolute fortune for a renovation back then, to transform the greasy space into the swankiest, most sophisticated adult nightclub Robbinsdale had ever seen. He named it appropriately, Someplace Else.
and it featured a spectacular exterior sign with 777 individual light bulbs, by far the largest and brightest sign on West Broadway, and the entrance was straight out of a James Bond spy movie. You'd walk into a dead-end, windowless foyer and pay your cover charge at a small ticket window, and a solid wall bookcase would magically slide upward into the ceiling to reveal a hidden entrance into the club. It was triggered by an operator sitting at an old-fashioned telephone switchboard.
And inside, it was literally a trip around the world. It featured heavily themed rooms like Paris, Ireland, and a South Seas room complete with massive glowing live aquariums. Because of the gorgeous ambiance, Flaherty was able to bring in jaw-dropping elite national talent. We're talking about the Everly Brothers, who actually hung out after their set and drank local Grain Belt beer with the ordinary customers. Also Bobby Goldsboro, jazz legend Ramsey Lewis, and the divine Sarah Vaughan.
But despite booking music royalty, Flaherty was quickly going completely broke. And it all goes back to that 3-2 beer law we discussed earlier. Because of Robbinsdale's stubborn protective ordinances designed to protect the ugly municipal lounge, Flaherty could only get a license to serve 3-2 beer. He couldn't get a liquor license, and he couldn't even get a setup license for people who brought their own bottles.
Flaherty famously complained to Jim Klobuchar that he had to charge a massive $3.50 cover charge just to break even on a superstar like Sarah Vaughan, because, as he bluntly put it, there's just so much 3-2 beer an adult human being can drink before developing severe symptoms of bloat. He blasted the conservative city council in the press, calling Robbinsdale a backward place with a dead bottom and a main street you can shoot a cannon down at 8 p.m. without hitting a single living soul.
Yep, and by late 1967, Flaherty admitted total defeat on trying to attract the adult crowd. Adults wanted real cocktails. So he closed the restaurant portion of the club, threw up his hands, and made a radical pivot. He converted the swank, sophisticated adult nightclub into a high-energy teen nightclub for ages 16 to 20.
And it became an absolute instantaneous sensation. Because teenagers couldn't legally buy hard liquor anyway, teens from all over the entire Twin Cities metro area poured into Robbinsdale every single weekend. Business was booming so hard that local parents complained their kids were secretly filching rare coins and old silver certificates from family collections just to have enough cash to pay the cover charge.
But a massive weekly influx of thousands of teenagers scared the living daylights out of quiet Robbinsdale. The city manager sent Flaherty an aggressive, formal letter complaining about the massive police manpower required just to monitor the traffic and crowds outside the club. To try and force him out, the city council jacked up Flaherty's annual license fee from a modest $200 to a staggering $1,000 overnight.
To keep the peace and protect his investment, Flaherty ran an incredibly tight ship. He hired the most popular athletic kids from the local high schools, dressed them up in matching sharp sports coats, and made them bouncers to keep their own peers in line. He enforced a strict dress code, so no grease, no tears in your clothing. He banned motorcycle gangs entirely, and even installed secret one-way mirrors in the men's room.
What the hell?
So security guards could watch out for smuggled contraband or real liquor. Which is a little bit creepy.
Yeah. In 1968, Flaherty sold the business to Arthur H. Lund, a retired 53-year-old advertising executive. It's unclear why he bought the business, although he did mention he had four children between the ages of 13 and 19. He didn't like rock and roll, though, and he often hid in the basement to avoid it. To cut costs down, he cut down on security with disastrous results. On May 10th and 11th, 1968, police from Robbinsdale, Crystal, and Hennepin County Sheriff's Department broke up a possible gang fight. Five people were arrested, four of whom were under 18. Police broke up a brawl on Friday the 10th. On Saturday, a fight broke out outside with 150 people gathered. The Saturday incident started at 41st Avenue North and West Broadway, and police had to move the crowd back until they were all the way down there by the Red Barn a couple blocks south. Then it got worse.
On Friday, August 16th, 1968, a 17-year-old got thrown out for being drunk. He drew a pistol from a small holster attached to his belt and shouted, "I'm going to shoot, I really am," according to the police chief. He threatened 6 to 8 people before firing several shots in the parking lot across the street. He hit 18-year-old Gary Hendrickson in the chest, critically wounding him with a bullet that lodged in his lung. The shooter was disarmed by bystanders before police came. The club someplace else was suspended by the city council for 8 days at a meeting on August 26, 1968. 200 to 300 people showed up for the meeting, many of them teenagers. Parents wanted it closed. Teens wanted it to stay open. City manager George DeLay cited previous trouble, which resulted in fighting, a knifing, underage drinking, and finally the shooting. Police Chief George Roop read a list of 24 incidents that had happened since March, including minors being drunk, fights, thefts from auto, use of false identification, clashes involving black and white youths, and mugging of girls by other girls. On September 3rd, 1968, Someplace Else was closed down for good.
Yeah, Someplace Else didn't last forever, but for a few wild years in the late 1960s, it proved Robbinsdale was capable of being truly someplace else.
Yeah, it really shows that from the packed streetcars of 1905 to the rockin' teenagers of 1967, Robbinsdale was always trying to find a balance between being a quiet, respectable suburb and the most exciting, rowdy destination in the country. And the town's battle with the bottle didn't stop when the 1970s rolled around either. Robbinsdale continued to rewrite its liquor laws for decades to come, eventually closing the historic municipal lounge altogether as modern bars and restaurants took over.
Crystal, we've essentially covered an entire lifetime of local lore today, so we'll save the next 55 years of modern booze battles for a future episode.
And Pete, we had so much great information about Someplace Else. Where did you find all this great information?
Well, Jeannie Anderson runs a wonderful website called Twin City Music Highlights, and if you haven't checked it out, she's got every club you can ever think of, and so a great website to have a look at.
Big thanks to you, Jeannie. We appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for listening. I'm Crystal Boyd. Robbinsdale Revisited is brought to you by the Robbinsdale Historical Society. Our little history museum is located at 4915 42nd Avenue North in the heart of Robbinsdale. We're open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 to 3. You can also visit us online at robbinsdale.org. You found this episode, so you know where to find the next one.
Bicycle into the city every Saturday to see our friends. Back home, sitting hand in hand, when the evening ends, when the evening ends, when the evening ends, in Robbinsdale, in Robbinsdale. Ooh.
Our theme music is provided by Gabe Barnett and Them Rounders.
Oh, yeah.